Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am going to skip any usual persiflage and plunge right into my speech. I have a borrowed watch and I can't read it. And nobody said, but some thought, well, I hope you have a calendar, you know. It was almost exactly 2,000 years ago, 2,010 years, if you want to be precise, that Marcus Tullius Cicero, obviously referring to Julius Caesar, although he was too smart to mention the name, said that an ungoverned populace usually chose as its leader someone bold and unscrupulous who curries favor with the people by giving them other men's property. Now, on January 15, 1964, in a speech at the White House, President Lyndon B. Johnson said, quote, "We are going to try to take all of the money that we think is unnecessarily being spent and take it from the haves and give it to the have-nots that need it so much." End of quotation. Now, Lyndon Johnson is hardly a Julius Caesar, but maybe he ought to get some ghostwriters who have read a bit more history to stay out of such embarrassing parallels. Our guest who made this statement, quote, "I want all to have a share of everything and all property to be in common. There will no longer be either rich or poor, no longer shall we see one man harvesting vast tracts of land while another has not ground enough to be buried in. I intend that there shall only be one and the same condition of life for all. I shall begin by making land, money, everything that is private property, common to all." End of quotation. If you guessed Eleanor Roosevelt, you are badly wrong. For these are the words which, in about 400 years before Christ, 2,300 years ago, more, the playwright Aristophanes put in the mouth of one of his female characters as a means of satirizing the communists, and we do mean communists, of his day. And at just about that same time, 400 B.C., Isocrates remarked that the enemies of Athens certainly ought to pay the Athenian assembly for convening so frequently because of all the mistakes that the Athenian assembly was making. Now, we could readily fill 100 pages with similar repetitions by history of men's venal hypocrisies, but that's not our assignment tonight. We have merely introduced those samples to show why we go back such a distance into the past to creep up on the present. For this, ladies and gentlemen, will be a serious speech. Some of it may not even be too easy to follow and digest when so much compacted substance is thrown at you so fast. But there have never been more serious times. And in discussing with you the problems and dangers which we face and the proposed answers and remedies based primarily on man's past experience, I want to go far enough back to start from a solid base. So please bear with me while I sound like a history lesson for the first part of this discourse. Confucius said that all men are born good. Leibniz said that everything is for the best in this, the best of all possible worlds. Some theologians will dispute both statements as heresy. Some philosophers will proclaim that neither sentence means anything except as a study in definitions. And some plain everyday cynics will tell you that both pronouncements are gross exaggerations, to say the least. Now, we have no wish to get into any of those arguments. We merely want to point out that, however little some of us know about the ultimate beginnings and bases of the struggle, there has been a visible and unceasing battle between the forces of evil and the forces of good, both among all mankind and even in the nature of individual man, from as far back as we can see in history. Now, this eternal war between good and evil has been fought on many fronts, in many ways, and with many weapons. We wish to deal tonight with just one front. This is the area in which the forces of evil have fought under the banner of collectivism, and the forces of good have defended themselves as well as they could under the banner of individual rights and responsibilities. Now, we occasionally catch glimpses of confused and confusing engagements on this front, even in the ancient civilizations of Egypt and of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. But in those days and places, the tyranny of government over its subjects was quite frankly imposed and maintained by sheer military might. There was no pretense about government owing its power to the consent of the governed. The early Asiatic rulers, anyway, Carlyle was writing doubtful etymology but quite sound sociology in the famous line which is usually paraphrased, "He is king who can." So in the age of the pharaohs, the battle lines between good and evil, or even between freedom and tyranny, were seldom drawn on the front between individuality and collectivism. By the time of Solon, however, in the first half of the 6th century BC, a new theory was being accepted, that government owed its power to the consent of those governed. This was the basic theme of democracy. And in many ways, it represented a huge advance over the Asiatic principle of governmental power resting on sheer might. But unfortunately, the forces of evil early recognized that the consent of the governed could readily be reduced in practice to the whim of the mob, that it could be made to derive from the bigotry of the ignorant, the enviousness of the irresponsible, the greed of the shiftless, the self-righteousness of the uncle good, and even from the manipulation by clever agents of the quite temporary passions of a volatile people. The consent of the governed soon became merely the mechanics by which demagogues put themselves in power. Since these demagogues, to obtain the support of the mobs and masses, usually made the natural pitch of promising to take from the haves and give to the have-nots, and since increasing agencies of government were always necessary to handle and effectuate these transfers, the meshing of demagoguery and collectivism was as inevitable as sunrise. And so the forces of evil, which appeal to the laziness, the selfishness, the rapacity, and to all of the criminal tendencies of man, early became the continuing matrix of these recurrent alliances between demagogues and the rabble. For the forces of evil sought always to destroy or weaken man's slowly building traditions of morality, of property rights, of the rights and responsibilities of the individual. And there was no surer nor quicker way to damage these mores than through the government of tyrants who derived their power from mob instincts which placed no value on the individual. Now, the early growth in the Greek world of the city-state tyrannies based on this process was due in part to Solon's having been preoccupied with a system of laws without consideration for a system of government through which those laws were to be enforced. There was not even the attempt, so valued by Thomas Jefferson 2,400 years later, to bind successive rulers down by the chains of a constitution, with the result that from the time of Solon until Oriental ideas of government by sheer military power were reimposed by Alexander the Great near the end of the 4th century BC, democracy ran wild throughout the Greek world. Any ambitious and ruthless enough criminal could make himself the tyrant, as these rulers of city-states were quite properly called, by masquerading his crimes as still further advances of collectivism for the good of the people, with one interesting result that was quite beneficial to any real future progress of mankind in connection with problems of social organization. This was that by the beginning of the Christian era, the most intelligent Romans had learned even more from the history of the Greeks than from the experiences of their own country, that an unbridled democracy was the worst of all forms of government. In the meantime, the Romans had devised the first real republic in history. With that diffusion of governmental power and system of checks and balances, which were designed to protect a people from the results of their own ephemeral follies. So that by the time the Romans adopted the laws of Solon in 454 BC, the Romans, had a permanent framework of government through which these laws were to be maintained, enforced, and made binding on rulers as well as on those ruled. Unfortunately, however, the forces of evil had already learned the irresistible power of the collectivist appeals, and the legal guardrails erected by pioneering forefathers could only hold back the mob for a while. They could not stop the mob from gradually trampling down these barriers in recurrent and ever greater stampedes towards socialist morasses, which were pictured by the collectivists, of course, as greener pastures. In fact, most of the demagogic ideological appeals which are used by the collectivists as their strongest weapons to this very day were already commonplace by the time the Roman Republic itself had been converted by successive criminal tyrants into a democracy. The principle of agrarian reform that you hear so much about today, which is a fancy liberal name for stealing land from its owners and distributing it to the far more numerous tenants. Agrarian reform was used by the Gracchi in the 2nd century BC as opportunistically as by Mao Zedong 2100 years later and by dozens of equal scoundrels in between. And the extension of the vote to new classes in order to dilute the influence of the solid citizenry and increase the weight of the rootless mobs was advocated by the Gracchi with the same arguments used by those who wish to reduce the voting age today to include irresponsible college pranksters. By the turn of the 1st century BC, Gaius Marius could have given Charles de Gaulle lessons in how to murder and imprison his anti-collectivist enemies by quasi-legal means. And by 50 BC, that tribune of the people, Gaius Salus, could have taught economic demagoguery to Huey Long and simultaneous personal fortune grabbing to Eleanor Roosevelt. By now, by this time, 50 BC, the forces of evil had learned well from massive experience to use government as the instrumentality through which to achieve their ambitions and to use the demagogic appeal of bread and circuses for the masses as a means of controlling that instrumentality known as government. The phrase that there is nothing new under the sun was itself once new. Everything about the deceptive, dishonest, and destructive processes of collectivism have, of course, been new at some point in the gradual evolution of the massive sociological machinery with which the criminal manipulators now pursue their own power and happiness. But since the time when a Caesar became Augustus, there has been little except refinements and enlargements in the basic tricks of the demagogue's trade. The difference between the coin clipping by Roman emperors, the printing of paper money without substance under it by practically all modern governments, and the dilution of the value of our own currency by the more intricate shenanigans of our Federal Reserve System is entirely a difference in mechanics and not in either morality or purpose. These operations are all simply the means by which a government brazenly but insidiously steals from its own people for the benefit of those who control the government. The price controls and wage controls and all of the similar procedures of economic regimentation for burying the rights and responsibilities of individuals under the huge palimpsest of government's rights and responsibilities as inaugurated by Diocletian in around 300 A.D., were necessarily changed in scope, but not changed at all in principles when reestablished as Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal 1,600 years later. And while that powerful modern slogan for the philosophical defense of collectivism, namely the greatest good of the greatest number, appears to have been created in approximately that form by Francis Hutcheson about 1720, and made the basis of so-called philosophic radicalism by Jeremy Bentham and the Mills only a century and a quarter ago, there is little change in it from the thoughts with which Plato had infected the minds of men more than 2,000 years before. Plato, Bentham, James Mill, and John Stuart Mill all undoubtedly had the best of intentions. But that fact does not alter one bit the uses to which their fantastic misconceptions as to the sources of both progress and true humanitarianism in human society have been put by megalomaniacal or cold-blooded criminals who sought only their own greatest gain under the pretense of these ideals. Of course, there were contemporaries of John Stuart Mill who saw the fallacies in the utilitarian philosophy as a guide to government. Bulwer Lytton acidly commented that the greatest happiness of the greatest number is best secured by a prudent consideration for number one. And Herbert Spencer came up with one of the most penetrating epigrams of all time. The ultimate effect, he said, of shielding men from the effects of folly is to fill the world with fools. But there is little basically different, even in these criticisms, of the excuses and the mechanics of the collectivists from what Aristophanes had been saying in Athens in 400 B.C. There has, nevertheless, been a tremendous increase during the past two centuries in the efficacy, the unceasing impact, and the deadliness of the collectivist weapons. It is the basic reason for this huge difference which is the chief theme of our concern tonight. And that difference, which has made the horror of the collectivist drive so much worse, its impact so much greater, ladies and gentlemen, that difference can be expressed quite simply in just one word: organization. Under Pisistratus during the early part of the 6th century B.C., or under Clisthenes at the end of that century, the use of the hypocrisies and agitations of class struggle by those men to establish and maintain themselves in power was a recurrent but disconnected and more or less haphazard manifestation of mere personal opportunism. The forces of evil were continuous, but the continuity of their collectivist activity was not maintained by any organizations transcending the lives of individual tyrants. Even up to the time of Pericles, the strongly collectivist measures of this ruler were carried out with full lip service being paid to the freedom of individuals and on the supposedly immediate consent, rather than any vested consent, by those being governed to the mushrooming of the functions of government. But by this time, in Sparta, a whole new psychological factor had been brought into the struggle. This was a collectivist tyranny that was self-perpetuating through whatever oligarchic rulers might successively wield the power of government, which brazenly claimed the vested right and did exercise the continuing power to absorb all privileges and all responsibilities into the hands of government, doling out to individuals only such narrowly restricted areas of personal freedom as the government chose to grant. No longer did a collectivist tyranny die, at least temporarily, with a particular tyrant. No longer did the collectivist forces of evil have to roll with the punch at each new interregnum between their agents until rallied again behind some strongman opportunist of sufficient ruthlessness and cunning. The control by these forces of the instrumentalities of government power and of all the brutalizing, stultifying, destructive mechanics and propaganda of collectivism was now continuous from one generation to the next. For the forces of individualism to reassert themselves under these circumstances, not just the ephemeral power of a single tyrant, but the entrenched power of the whole Spartan system had to be overthrown. And this factor of continuity and organization was of sufficient importance to enable Sparta, through two generations of mixed Cold War and Hot War, to conquer the Greek world and to keep its collectivist tyranny imposed on this whole Greek world, including Athens, for yet another full generation. In fact, the pattern for all future completely totalitarian collectivist regimes was so well established by fascist Sparta that there is only one major difference between its basic philosophy and that of our Soviet enemies today. And the economic and political organization of the Spartan state, as well as the methods of infiltration and subversion which it used for gradual conquest of the whole Greek world, were so similar to those of Soviet Russia as to astound anybody who studies this subject for the first time. But the Spartan tyranny was eventually overthrown before any new clique of collectivist brutalizers could establish themselves with a continuous organization in power. Alexander the Great had brought the whole Greek world, had brought Greece under the sway of a worldwide despotism. With the frankly Oriental concept restored, that governmental powers derived not from the counting of oyster shells, but from the sweep of a sword. And by the time Alexander's empire fell to pieces, Rome was introducing a whole new era, and in many respects a whole new civilization, to the pages of man's history. So that Sparta remained as an example to be followed, a goal to be sought, and an experience from which to profit on the part of collectivists of later centuries. But it did not establish an esoteric core of uninterrupted organizational permanence to control and guide collectivist drives for power in the centuries ahead. The precedent had been set, however, and the vision obviously reoccurred to many evil men during those 2,000 years. There were many small sects and heresies and societies and associations of which we catch fleeting glimpses now and then, from the early centuries of the Christian era until they proliferated into numerous clumps of unsightly or even poisonous intellectual weeds after 1700. How many of them there were, each of which intended to be the embryo of an organization that would grow in power until it ruled the whole world, we do not know. For a high degree of secrecy was not only essential to any even temporary success on the part of any of these nefarious collections of criminal con men, but the thrill of belonging to some mysterious and powerful inner circle was one of the strongest appeals any such group could offer to prospective recruits. We do know, however, from hundreds of small leaks and published accounts, that the doctrines which gave many of these secret groups their cohesiveness and continuity would fall clearly and by the most tolerant classification into the category of evil. Also, that by the 18th century AD, these various doctrines had pretty much coalesced into a uniformly satanic creed and program, which was to establish the power of the sect through the destruction of all governments, all religion, all morality, all economic systems, and was to substitute the sheer physical force of the lash and the bayonet for all other means by which previous governments, good or bad, had contrived to rule mankind. And a most important of these groups, which is now generally meant when we use the term Illuminati, although many others had called themselves by that same name, was founded on May 1st, 1776 by Adam Weishaupt. Despite the extreme secrecy with which this group cloaked itself from the very beginning, one early raid by the Bavarian government, another raid about 3 years later, the partial confessions at one arraignment of four men fairly high up in the conspiracy, all of whom incidentally were professors, and a few more or less accidental discoveries or disclosures from other sources have made the original nature, purposes, and methods of the Illuminati quite well known. Since by 1800, they were able to pull the veil of secrecy over themselves almost completely and permanently, we do not know to what extent Weishaupt's group became the central core or even one of the main components of a continuing organization with increasing reach and control over all collectivist activities after 1776. But that there have been one or more such organizations which have now been absorbed into the top echelons of the communist conspiracy, or vice versa, is supported by too much evidence of too many kinds to permit much doubt. Both because of the strong probability that Weishaupt's Illuminati has been the dominant factor in this development, therefore, and because if there has been some even more secret and more successful group to fill the role, it is bound to have had an extreme degree of similarity to the Weishaupt clique, it is worthwhile for us to take a paragraph or so to examine some of the clearly established facts about this particular sect of Illuminati. For a mere recital of these facts will show, among other things, how inevitable is the conclusion that the present worldwide communist conspiracy has evolved out of some such earlier organization. And the more diligently and the longer you have studied the communist conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen, the more clearly you will recognize the parallels just from the small part I can present here of, about the Illuminati. Now, there was published in 1798 a book which is now extremely rare, but of which I do have a copy, in which 130 pages were devoted to exposure of the Illuminati. This exposure consisted primarily of testimony and letters which had been made available through raids or investigations ordered by the Elector of Bavaria. In the June 1962 issue of American Opinion, Dr. Revelo Oliver gave the substance of the information which had come to light through a raid in 1786 on the home of a high-ranking member of the Illuminati named Zwack. From these several direct, primary, and contemporary sources, it is easy to assemble the following fully documented picture. One, selected neophytes were brought into the order of the Illuminati in the conviction that its general object was the happiness of the human race. After about 3 years of receiving intensive instruction and observation as a novitiate, such lesser members were called Minervals, those selected to be taken further were given a fuller explanation. The aim of the order, they then learned, was, quote, to make of the human race, without any distinction of nation, condition, or profession, one good and happy family, unquote. Does that sound familiar? Two, by this time also, the Minerval, if accepted to go on to becoming an Illuminatus Minor, was being taught that all religion was merely superstition, which should be abandoned in favor of enlightenment. In other words, illumination and of the triumph of reason. Note that word reason. From then on, it's a very important part of all the collectivist drive and philosophy. One of the idealistic inducements which brought many recruits into the order was the assurance that it would help to spread the purest and noblest form of Christianity. Yet many Protestant ministers, during the initial 3 years of brainwashing to which they were subjected, and this is way back at the end of the 18th century, then actually came, during those 3 years, to equate the doctrines and purposes of the order with the purest form of Christianity, and were ready to shift their allegiance to the worship of reason by the time they were called upon to do so. Three, loyalty to the temporal powers of the time was solemnly promised by the order and was understood by new members to be a firm principle of the order when they took the oath as Minervals. By the time one came, however, to take the far more serious oath as an Illuminatus Minor, he was already accepting the doctrine that the happiness of the human race required the uniting of all the inhabitants of the earth into one great family, that the abolition of national differences and animosities being requisite to this end, patriotism was a narrow-minded sentiment incompatible with the more enlarged views and purposes of the order, and that consequently all ruling princes were to be regarded as unnecessary and expendable. Loyalty to the order was represented as morally far superior to loyalty to governments or to the ruling powers. One passage in Weishaupt's own explanation of the oath required at this point in a member's progress, which is given in a letter that he certainly never intended should be made public, is so revealing as to merit quoting in full. "These ruling powers are despots," he says, "when they do not conduct themselves by the order's principles. And it is therefore our duty to surround them with the order's members so that the profane may have no access to them. Thus we are able most powerfully to promote the order's interest. If any person is more disposed to listen to princes than to the order, he is not fit for it and must rise no higher. We must do our utmost to procure the advancement of Illuminati into all important civil offices." End of the quotation. As a corollary to these instructions, it is to be noted, Weishaupt's Illuminati contrived to place their members as tutors to youths of great rank or importance. They managed by influence and intrigue to get dignitaries favorable to themselves appointed to higher offices. And the diligence and skill with which they worked at promoting each other is illustrated by the fact that within a comparatively few years, all of the chairs at Weishaupt's own University of Ingolstadt, with just two exceptions, were occupied by Illuminati. When you thus realize that the communists today may have had 150 years of cumulative experience at these tricks, you cease to marvel at what they accomplish with such comparatively small numbers. 4, sensual pleasures were to be given high rank among those to be pursued for the happiness of mankind. This was gradually to be made clear to the minerals, and the release by enlightenment or illumination of the restrictions on such sensual pleasures as formerly imposed by their consciences, this release was to be one of the subconscious appeals leading them to the worship of reason instead of religion. 5, nothing was more insistently and repeatedly emphasized on members than the propriety of employing for a good purpose, good in their viewpoint, the means which the wicked employed for evil purposes. It was taught that the preponderance of good, that is good from the order's point of view, in the ultimate result of any action to be considered, made any means justifiable, and that wisdom and virtue consisted of properly determining this balance with regard to any situation. More specifically, nothing was to be scrupled at if the superiors of the member could make it appear that the order would derive advantage from it, because the great objective of the order was superior to all other considerations. 6, the method of education of the minerals was intended to make them and all members of the society spies on all other members. One of the most important activities of a mineral by which he was judged as to whether he should be advanced to the next level consisted of the sealed reports he was required to turn in to superiors he had never seen on the methods and efficiency and views of the immediate superior who was giving him his 3 years of instructions. 7, keeping secret all of the activities of the order and even its very existence was stressed at all times as of the utmost importance, and dire vengeance was promised any member who ever betrayed its secrets, even if he had been dismissed or for any other reason had ceased to be a member. 8, self-criticisms by a member of his own failures and shortcomings, especially with regard to his conduct on any occasions where he himself had doubts as to its propriety or wisdom, were required by his superiors. Any such reports or confessions were to include some account of his friendships and of his unorthodox opinions, as well as of his conduct on such occasions. 9. The most important of all knowledge for a member to acquire was an understanding of human character and motivations. For only thus would the member be able to bend those with whom he came in contact to the service of the order's purpose. 10. The baneful influence of accumulated property was declared to be an insurmountable obstacle to the happiness of any nation. Although the order chose by preference to recruit from the younger sons of important families who might be encouraged to resentment against the results of the rules of primogeniture, still the full impact of this principle of the society with regard to property was not made clear until the Minerval progressed to the point of taking his oath as an Illuminatus Minor. At that time, this long and solemn oath included the following, quote, this is the end of 3 years of training. I bind myself to perpetual silence and unshaken loyalty and submission to the order in the person of my superiors, here making a faithful and complete surrender of my private judgment, my own will, and every narrow-minded employment of my power and influence. I pledge myself to account the good of the order as my own, and am ready to serve it with my fortune, my honor, and my blood. Should I, through omission, neglect, passion, or wickedness, behave contrary to the good of the order, I subject myself to what reproof or punishment my superiors shall enjoin. That's the end of the quotation from the oath. All of the above, and a great deal more, the Minerval had learned and promised by the time he really became a fully accepted member of the order. The training, the disillusionment, the gradual acceptance of the real purposes of the order continued until one who was properly qualified became at last a member of the inner circle. By that time, the following facts had been made crystal clear to him, and he was a party to all that they signified. A, the purpose of the order was to rule the world. B, in order to accomplish this, it would first be necessary to destroy contemporary civilization. This specifically included the overthrow of all existing governments, the merging of all nationalities and races into one people under one government, the abolition of all private property, the destruction of all religion, and the abrogation of all morality. C, any and all means were to be used to achieve this end. Whatever helped the order was good. Whatever hindered it was bad. D, a philosophical front glorifying equality and a new kind of morality were to be utilized wherever they would serve. The essence of the, quote, morality, unquote, was that the world should come to be ruled only by able men and good men in all positions and at all levels. But the important and undisclosed catch was that who qualified as good men and able men was to be determined solely by the order. E, any and all persons of whatever rank or character who could forward the purposes of the order in any way were to be utilized as much as possible, without any necessity for them to be members, and perhaps without their even knowing of the order's existence. F, this incredibly ambitious undertaking was to be conducted as a conspiracy, and secrecy at every point and at all times was of utmost importance. Now, one or two somewhat incidental comments seem to be worth the space before we move on. It was made a custom from the very beginning to use the names of ancient cities to represent the cities of Europe in all of their correspondence, and for those high enough up in the order to choose fictitious names by which they would always be identified in correspondence or otherwise to other members of the inner circle. Cato, Marius, Brutus, Pythagoras, Socrates, Hannibal were typical of the names selected. Weishaupt, head of the order, called himself Spartacus, for the man who led the most famous slave revolt in Roman history. May we be pardoned for a mild speculation as to whether this accounts in some degree, directly or indirectly, for the great current veneration for the slave leader Spartacus in the minds of so many liberals. Second, the important leaders of the Illuminati, ladies and gentlemen, really practiced what they preached with regard to morality. They were liars and scoundrels and embezzlers and debauchers all, in their personal lives as well as in line of duty. One of the great concerns of Spartacus, popping up here and there in the very correspondence which was uncovered, was how to have Cato's sister murdered in order to prevent the public learning that he, Weishaupt Spartacus, had seduced her, and that his attempts to have the secret buried by an abortion had failed. His justification for the desired murder was that the damage which these disclosures might do to his reputation would be harmful to the order.
This is the end of side one. At this point, stop the tape and turn the cassette over for the continuation of the program on side two.